Chapter 7 Trial by February. Our first full month in the White House was like living inside an emotional washing machine that only made you feel dirtier with every rinse. Even though I believed we'd come out ahead, I felt like I was being dragged down. I missed my family. I missed my old life. AWOL FLOTUS. I had never been a secret special advisor in the White House before. Melania had never been First Lady before. Since Melania was still living in New York, she wasn't even a full-time First Lady yet. Our team of Lindsay, Ricky, Tim, Emily, Vanessa, Stephanie Grisham, Mary Kate, David Mann, and I was a motley crew. Every single thing we did or didn't do was under the media microscope. Even if Melania didn't do anything, it made news. On January 30th, 2017, the front page of the Washington Post Style section dubbed her the AWOL First Lady. After speaking with Melania, I emailed Reince Priebus and Katie Walsh, attaching the article, and said, "I understand that we have hiring restrictions, but when it comes to the detriment of the First Lady, see below, it is not something we can ignore. We have an incredibly qualified communications director, Jessica Boulanger, who is eager to begin, but we need budget approval. We do not need a lot of staff, but we do need qualified staff." 2 days later, February 1st, wrote a blistering article by CNN's Kate Bennett and Betsy Klein called "Wither Melania Trump, 12 Days Without a Public Sighting." The gist of it was, while the president was making news with his executive orders and the travel ban, Melania was missing in action. Where had Melania been since the inauguration? It wasn't exactly a mystery. She was home at Trump Tower with Barron. I was endeavoring to solidify the staff, do the renovations, and field press queries. Not a minute went by that we weren't scrambling to get things done. But the frenzy behind the scenes didn't matter if nothing was going on in the public eye. The CNN piece said that Melania's 20 to 30 staff slots, I wish, remained wide open and that she hadn't announced an initiative or a social schedule of events. The tone mocked her as a do-nothing first lady who was so uninterested in her role that she refused to visit D.C., let alone move there. The official reason Melania had decided to stay in New York was so that she could be with Barron while he finished the school year, at a total cost of $150,000 per day for added security and traffic control around Trump Tower. In an interview with the New York Times, Donald said that Melania and Barron would move to Washington very soon and would visit on the weekends. The truth? She really did want Barron to finish off the school year in New York. But also, renovations to the White House residence weren't finished yet, and she wasn't going to move into a construction site. Every day, as her spokesperson, I had to defend her decision and swear that the First Lady would, one day, be thrilled to move to D.C. and was ecstatic to be FLOTUS. I was quoted in the CNN Wither article, "Mrs. Trump is honored to serve this country and is taking the role and responsibilities of First Lady very seriously. It has only been a short time since the inauguration, and the First Lady is going to go about her role in a pragmatic and thoughtful way that is unique and authentic to her." The line of that article that got under my skin? When Trump boarded Marine One to pay his respects to a fallen service member's family in Delaware, he was accompanied by first daughter, Ivanka, a reminder that she is his closest family in Washington. As irritating as they were, AWOL FLOTUS articles were only presenting the evidence. Melania lived in New York. She didn't appear in public or release statements to the press. Her social media was quiet. Ivanka rushed in to fill the void as the acting First Lady, issuing constant social media posts and press releases galore about her involvement with women's issues, lobbying daddy about climate change, alas, unsuccessfully, and attending every meeting she could slink her way into. To prove to the press that we were filling slots, I sent a draft of yet another press statement to Hope Hicks for approval so we could finally announce Lindsay as chief of staff and myself as senior advisor. 4 hours later, Hicks emailed, "Looks fine. I assume you have connected with Reince, Katie, counsel, adding needed parties here." Katie Walsh confirmed at 8 p.m. that she'd sent out the press release. I texted Melania, "It's out." Except, my name wasn't mentioned. It was only about Lindsay, her experience in political fundraising, event management, and logistics, her previous service for President George W. Bush, a quote from her about reopening the White House visitor's office. My name, title, bio, and quote had to be removed. It was a gut punch to be deleted from the statement I had written. In a series of emails to Ryan's, Hope, and Katie, we got to the bottom of my erasure. Apparently, the protocol office in the West Wing didn't know what to call me and what type of contract to give me. The press had been referring to me as a senior or special advisor to the First Lady, but my official role was yet to be named or announced because I was waiting for counsel to get me a contract. The White House lawyers, Don McGahn, the very same Don McGahn whom Donald had railed about the night he fired Rick Gates from the pick, and Stefan Pazentino, the White House deputy counsel in charge of ethics policy, were trying to figure out what to call me, given the unorthodox nature of my role, unpaid and under the radar. And only once they cracked that mystery would an announcement be made. It never was. Melania was hopping mad and reached out to me to say she wanted my press release to go out, and Ryan's needed to get it and move on it. Then she wanted to know if I had secured my phone. Can you imagine Barbara Bush or Hillary Clinton being ignored or denied by West Wing bureaucrats the freedom to send out a press release to announce her choice for a senior advisor? It was like Priebus, Walsh, Hicks, and Joe Hagan, Deputy Chief of Staff for Operations, put all of Melania's emails, texts, memos, and phone transcripts into a paper shredder. In our private discussions, Melania and I talked about why the delays and runarounds were happening. We circled around it again and again, asking, who gains from an impotent, invisible First Lady? Our list was short, very short. Seeing red. Lindsay, Tim, and I were preparing Melania's schedule for the week ahead. We had everything under control. She'd be leaving Trump Tower on Friday with her father to meet Donald in Palm Beach. I read the flight manifest, a description of the trip that included specific instructions about food and beverage preferences. The manifest had a warning. As an FYI, Muse, Melania's Secret Service name, has an almond allergy, to which we do not know the extent yet. The approved meal on the flight today has nuts and wanted to make you aware for future flight meal plan reviews. Wait. What? Melania was allergic to nuts? She knew what we'd been through over the years with Zach. She'd heard me sobbing over his scares and cheered him on during his desensitizing therapy and had given me sympathy and emotional support. All this time, she'd had a nut allergy and never once mentioned it to me? It seemed unthinkable, considering how many dozens of hours we'd spent talking about Zach. She knew I had put SWW Creative on the shelf for 2 years to enroll Zachary and a life-changing oral immunotherapy, OIT, food trial, under the oversight of Dr. Kyrie Nadeau, the director of the Sean N. Parker Center for Allergy and Asthma Research at Stanford University. I'd invited Melania to every fundraiser I'd organized for this cause over the years, but she'd always said she was unavailable for those particular events. To the best of my recollection, she'd never once written a check for them, either. I should have confronted her and said, "Almond allergy? What gives?" But I let it go, as I always did. I had every intention of picking it up later, when we had 5 minutes to breathe, and I had an inkling of what I'd say. I never did. On February 3rd, while Ivanka was spending the weekend in D.C., Melania joined her husband at Mar-a-Lago for the 60th International Red Cross Ball. Naively, I thought this trip would be well received. She would be seen in public, spending quality time with her husband. But the media found a way to trash her anyway. When Melania arrived in Palm Beach that day, she stepped off Air Force One in a red Givenchy cape dress. I'd kept hammering the American designers only rule. But what Melania wants, Melania gets. Kate Bennett tweeted, "Looks to me like at FLOTUS is wearing this $2,000 at Givenchy, raised hand emoji, it's me again, hashtag fashion detective," with a link to the dresses page at Net-a-Porter. Vanessa Friedman, the New York Times fashion director and chief fashion critic, requested a comment about why Mrs. Trump wore a French designer. And I said, it was in honor of National Wear Red Day, which is to highlight the importance and raise awareness about heart disease. Mrs. Trump is a proud and longtime supporter of American fashion. She appreciates fashion as art. As a former model, She has always been a patron of the world's most distinguished designers, both here and abroad. Mrs. Trump buys from an international mix of brands because that is what reflects her uniquely American life experience and style. At the Red Cross ball, Melania wore a hot pink Dior gown. She did wear garments by American designers, The Row and Derek Lam, at the Super Bowl party at the Trump International Golf Club on February 5th. But the media didn't care. They only reported Melania's slip-ups. I was incensed. We tried so hard to get it right, and they roasted her anyway. She said to me, "Why do you care? You can't win." But I wanted to win them over. I knew the media and the whole world could be convinced to love Melania, too. If only she'd stick with the plan. If only I had more help to do it. Once in a lifetime. Melania was not content with an apology and retraction from the Maryland blogger Tarpley and the Daily Mail about writing in the summer of 2016 that she'd once been an escort. She resued the British tabloid in New York for defamation to the tune of $150 million. The language of the complaint raised eyebrows. It said that the plaintiff, Melania, had the unique, once-in-a-lifetime opportunity as an extremely famous and well-known person, as well as a former professional model, brand spokesperson, and successful businesswoman, to launch a broad-based commercial brand in multiple product categories: apparel, accessories, makeup, hair care, jewelry, fragrance, each of which could have garnered multi-million dollar business relationships for a multi-year term during which plaintiff is one of the most photographed women in the world. Immediately, we got a query from journalist Julie Bykowitz, then a reporter at the Associated Press, who said, "That has been interpreted to mean she intends to make money from her exposure as First Lady of the United States. Is this the case? Is that appropriate? Do you have any other comments on this issue?" Melania instructed me to shut down Jessica from commenting on the multiple press inquiries about the lawsuit. Charles Harder, her attorney, replied to the AP himself. "The First Lady has no intention of using her position for profit and will not do so," he said. "It is not a possibility. Any statements to the contrary are being misinterpreted." 2 weeks later, Harder refiled the claim, taking out the phrase "once in a lifetime" and shifting the impact of the escort slur toward Melania's feelings. Per the revised complaint, defendant's false and inflammatory statements about plaintiff have caused tremendous harm to plaintiff's personal and professional reputation and prospective economic opportunities, as well as causing her significant humiliation and emotional distress. Unless you haven't been paying attention, you know by now that Melania doesn't register humiliation or distress. She was angry that complete strangers had used her story for their own profit and notoriety. She would tell Donald to stop talking about people. Every time he does it, he only makes them more famous, and that's what they want. As far as Melania's suffering great anguish about being misunderstood by the public, it did not happen. Ever the pragmatist, she reasoned that since she had no control over people's thoughts, why should she care what they believed? Pretty incredible wisdom, if you can actually pull that off. Mere mortals cannot, but our superwoman First Lady could and did. Melania settled with Tarpley, who, per Harder, agreed to pay a substantial sum as a settlement. She also settled with the Daily Mail, which agreed to pay her legal fees and damages, believed to be about $3 million. Melania was pleased about winning. But I wouldn't describe her reaction as celebratory or even victorious. In her mind, justice had been done. Journalists who knew me personally would contact me directly with press requests for Melania. But many requests went to the West Wing. The vexing trend of Stephanie Grisham sending the inquiries to Lindsay without CCing me continued. Hajimemashti. On the same day as the once-in-a-lifetime debacle, the First Lady's office received our instructions from the West Wing about the upcoming White House state visit with the Prime Minister of Japan, Shinzo Abe, and his wife, Aki Abe, kicking off on February 10th. The State Department's Office of the Chief of Protocol sent a briefing memo with background about Mrs. Abe. She is a fan of South Korean soap operas. She opened a pub that serves only organic food, etc., and Japanese etiquette. For example, when meeting people for the very first time, the Japanese say, "Hajimemashite," which translates to, "It is the first time," and not, "Konnichiwa," hello. I found that to be particularly relevant, since this was not only Abe and Donald's first meeting, but the first state visit for the Trumps and Melania's first diplomatic mission. We really wanted it to go well and took the reassurance from the State Department that, as the schedule solidified, they'd continue to provide protocol guidance for every aspect of the visit. There would be an exchange of diplomatic gifts, and the item itself was for us to choose. Lindsay told me, the gift can be up to $2,000, and it must be made in the USA, she said. What about a pashmina? Did she think that Mrs. Abe needed to be swaddled? No problem, I said. We'll think of something else. Ideally, the gift would have cultural or historical significance and relate to Melania's big-picture mission about the health and well-being of children and families or American design and creativity. After Lindsay prattled about how pretty the newly painted cotton candy pink walls were in Melania's office, which I had to have repainted, I didn't trust her to wrap a gift, much less choose one. As for her track record with gift spending, she was the one, along with Ramsey Ratcliffe, who'd blown the whole $500,000 Presidential Inauguration Committee gift budget on trinkets from the White House Historical Association. I turned to my consigliere, an arbiter of art and taste, David Mann, and he suggested a porcelain Rosenblum flower by Ukraine-born American artist Vladimir Konevsky. Melania loved it. We tried to arrange for the artist to add Mrs. Abe's initials to the gift, but there wasn't time. Gift done. On to scheduling. Tim Trepepi attended daily schedule briefings in the West Wing, where he learned that Mrs. Abe had plans on Friday afternoon to visit Gallaudet University and the Japanese Embassy for a meeting with the National Cherry Blossom Festival Committee. Via emails with the West Wing, we confirmed that Melania's official duties would begin when she and Donald accompanied the Abes to Palm Beach on Air Force One Friday evening. They would have dinner that night at Mar-a-Lago. The next day, Mrs. Trump and Mrs. Abe would tour the Murakami Museum and Japanese gardens in Delray Beach, followed by lunch and maybe a spa treatment to be named later. I'll let you know which service I'll have and which Mrs. Abe would like, Melania texted me. She probably would want to book a Tammy Fender facial for herself. We arranged for Melania to fly in from New York. We were all set and felt pretty good about our efforts. And then a bomb drop with Kate Bennett's name on it. Her article, Without Melania Trump, Mrs. Abe Rose Solo in Washington, came out on Friday afternoon. The big scoop was that Melania had broken long-standing tradition by not entertaining the spouse of a visiting dignitary while he was in a meeting with the president. Michelle Obama and Laura Bush had shown Mrs. Abe a good time in D.C. in years past, but Melania, the piece implied, couldn't be bothered to show up. Melania was outraged when she sent me the link. My response? OMG. What the fuck? The West Wing did this, said Melania. This is unacceptable. She reminded me that she had suggested a lunch with Mrs. Abe, but we were told that she already had plans. I emailed Lindsay. Read the CNN piece. This is horrible. MT is so angry. What can she do? Lindsay came back with some intel from Bennett's office. Kate said she called and emailed Jessica Boulanger, who had volunteered to handle Melania's press during the inauguration and we tried to hire but didn't have the budget for. But she never responded. And CNN ran with the story. We need to hire press people today. They are writing bad stories because we have been silent. I need those emails. Jessica didn't tell me because Jessica wasn't working with us anymore. Why did Bennett go to Jessica and not reach out to me? Besides that, if she didn't get a response, why didn't she next ask me? Lindsay said, I don't have them. And Katie Walsh, at the request / demand of President of the United States and First Lady of the United States, who are both really upset, is on the phone with Bennett, who wrote the story. I hunted down the emails that Kate Bennett and her colleague Betsy Klein had sent to Jessica the day before. Klein had written, checking back to see if you can provide any scheduling guidance for the First Lady tomorrow. Will she be in Washington to greet Mrs. Abe? We heard a rumor to the contrary, but let me know if you have anything reportable for us. Kate Bennett's February 9th email to Jessica, hey, any comment on this? Spicer from the gaggle a bit ago. I'm not sure. I think they're waiting until Barron gets out of school. I would have a hard time thinking that they're going to land in D.C. I would guess she would fly from New York straight to Florida. So will Mrs. Trump be in Washington, or will Ivanka Trump? Are either of them going to spend time with Mrs. Abe tomorrow in D.C.? Sean Spicer's alternative facts strike again. Bennett covered her ass by writing in the article, requests for clarification about Mrs. Trump's whereabouts earlier in the day on Friday went unanswered by the White House. Mrs. Trump has not yet named her own spokesperson. Bennett knew they should have reached out directly to me for comment, but that wouldn't have been in their best interest. Lindsay said, State Department was told Mrs. Abe had her own schedule and would meet at the airport. We never declined an invitation or were asked to participate in anything. West Wing Press Shop has offered to push back on it if we want and respond. Was she kidding? Let the West Wing Press Shop do what exactly? So far, they've done nothing for FLOTUS except jam us up. Melania texted the group to ask who was in charge of state visits. Was it Ryan's Priebus? Tim Trepepi reported, Everything goes through Ryan's Priebus, then through state, and then lastly through Jared. What? Jared? Jared Kushner was organizing state visits? The Secret Service and the State Department knew what Mrs. Abe's plans were because they organized her schedule hand in hand with Jared. As we were sorting all of this out, Melania was sitting on Air Force One with the Abes and Donald and dozens of others. With people all around her, I knew she'd keep her game face on. Behind the mask, though, she was seething. Her text came fast and furious. Send Ryan's the story. We need to contact CNN to make a retraction. Need to send them a statement. To fight back. Getting killed on social media. I told her to take a moment. Breathe. How could we handle this? Did we want to tell the world that the State Department and Jared had set up the First Lady to look bad? Melania was ready to have someone fired, and no one could blame her one tiny bit. I drafted a statement with Melania that she forwarded to Hicks and Spicer, hoping we could release it within the hour. I felt played by the State Department and was livid at Bennett. My first line of defense was to email her, lodging my complaint about her failure to confirm and clarify her information with the First Lady's office and for writing a story with a predetermined narrative that Melania was disregarding tradition before she had all the facts. She'd embarrassed the First Ladies of two countries so she could get her bogus scoop. To make matters worse, she tweeted Japan's First Lady, Ake Abe, attends tour of at Gallaudet U solo, without at FLOTUS or at Ivanka Trump to host, accompany. Very unusual. 2 hours after Melania sent my statement to Hicks and Spicer, they hadn't approved or released it. It seemed like blatant sabotage. Finally, it came out, and Bennett updated her story. Hours after the story was published Friday afternoon, Mrs. Trump's office released a statement explaining her whereabouts. The First Lady was very much looking forward to welcoming Mrs. Abe to the White House upon her arrival in Washington. However, she was informed that Mrs. Abe had previous commitments during her stay in D.C., the statement said. Throughout the evening, I updated Melania and kept one eye on the social media reaction to the story. Kate Bennett posted a few pictures of Jacqueline Kennedy in white pants and a navy top on Twitter. While flying to Palm Beach with the Abes, Melania wore a Michael Kors navy top and white slacks. Was Bennett implying that Melania paled in comparison to Jackie Kennedy? Enough was enough. The First Lady needed her entire statement made public. So I reached out to some of my major media contacts, relationships I'd built over the years based on hard work, respect, and integrity. I told them I needed to fix the misinformation Kate had disseminated to the world. By 10:19 p.m., 8 hours after Bennett's article was published, I had written to Melania, done, confirmed, online, on Don Lemon. It aired exclusively on CNN Tonight with Don Lemon. The First Lady was very much looking forward to welcoming Mrs. Abe to the White House upon her arrival in Washington. However, she was informed that Mrs. Abe had previous commitments during her stay in D.C. The First Lady flew to Andrews Air Force Base to meet the President, Prime Minister Abe, and Mrs. Abe to be able to fly with them on Air Force One, as it was Mrs. Abe's first opportunity to spend time with the First Lady. They will all be together for the weekend at Mar-a-Lago and have a full itinerary. Mrs. Trump is delighted to be able to welcome the Prime Minister and Mrs. Abe to the First Family's winter home, which is a very special place to her and to the entire Trump family. We remain eager to work with the media to inform the American people truthfully, with transparency and integrity, while adhering to the highest journalistic standards. We are only too happy to confirm the facts of a story prior to its publication when given the opportunity. It took me 12 hours to make this happen, but it had taken decades to build relationships with colleagues who respected and trusted me first. It was a crash course in crisis management for Lindsay. I schooled her on our policy going forward, 1. I will handle all false information that was published about the First Lady. 2. General inquiries and follow-ups could wait. 3. Everything went through us, not the West Wing. It was a rough day, but it ended well. Lindsay thanked me for handling this disaster. She texted, "We are out on a lifeboat alone, and it's beyond what I thought, and I'm realizing what you have been telling me all along is true." She'd missed the final weeks on the pick, after all. I replied, "Stay strong." After our mini-war together that day, I trusted Lindsay. For that matter, I also believed that if journalists had the correct information, they would hold themselves to high journalistic standards. Lindsay reported from Florida in the morning that her husband had given her a pep talk. He said, "Go work your ass off and take care of her. That is what you are there for. Assume no one is helping and fuck them for it. It's my motto today." I thought, "You go, girl." Melania invited Mrs. Abe to ride with her on Saturday morning to visit the Murakami Museum and Japanese Gardens. Betsy Klein asked for a comment, and I gave her a statement. Next, I had to prepare the exclusive fashion coverage for Women's Wear Daily. I texted Lindsay, who was glued to Melania's side. "What is she wearing?" "It's a long white dress and matching cardigan," she replied. Hervé had sent me a dozen photos for her looks for the weekend. "Calvin Klein?" I asked. Calvin Klein confirmed. I said, "Please tell me she has a slip on." The white fabric would leave little to the imagination. "No slip." Smile emoji. To bounce back, I wanted to make sure Melania and Mrs. Abe had a meaningful day. A garden tour didn't seem impactful enough, given Mrs. Abe's political activism and general gravitas. I texted Lindsay to ask Melania if it was possible for them to go to a church. I'd read in the State Department briefing that Mrs. Abe had grown up Catholic and was very involved with the church. I knew the Secret Service wouldn't be too thrilled that I was suggesting an OTR, off-the-record stop, but they were so much easier. No one was alerted that she'd be there. It was less time-consuming, with fewer budget burdens. Lindsay texted back. MT said she wants to drive Mrs. Abe down Ocean and Worth Avenue and then turn around at Bethesda by the Sea Church where MT goes. The same church she'd gotten married in. Then Mrs. Abe wants MT to take her to a Mar-a-Lago gift shop before they eat lunch. But were they stopping at the church or not? Were they going to take pictures? I needed to know to prepare Melania's social media postings. I was in charge of posting these items myself on her Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, in addition to all my other duties. Melania was picky about the captions, so the photos went through a rigorous vetting process. They went to the church and took photos, but Melania didn't like any of the pictures of the two of them. Too common, not artistic enough. So she sent me a shot of the church itself and told me to post this one with the cross. The photos of the garden tour were much more flattering. She sent two pictures and instructed me to get them online. A bit curt, I thought, but it's hard to interpret the tone of texts. She followed that up with rapid-fire instructions that made my head spin. Only number one first tweet with picture, number two and number three tweet no pic, Facebook number one with photo number two and number three, no photo, just post. Instagram, no number two or number three. The whole time she was sending me my posting orders, she was sitting next to Mrs. Abe in the car. Personal pictures were not official FLOTUS pictures on Instagram. We posted them anyway, a small act of rebellion to try to get some power back. We had no control over what the press would publish. I asked Lindsay how Melania was doing, which Lindsay promptly told Melania. She LOL'd and squinting face with tongue emojied at me, as if her well-being were a silly thing for me to worry about. "Business as usual for me," Melania said, "as long as they all do the job they need to." Meaning, as long as someone told her where to go, all she had to do was stand there and pose for photos. She was good. And she was. We all survived an exhausting run through the gauntlet of Hajimamashti. That evening, I texted Lindsay to thank her for her support and work, which very few people could possibly begin to understand. Her response rang true. There will be good days and bad days. We earn the shit out of these good days. If you don't count the Bennett article, Melania's first state visit had gone pretty well. The Abes and the Trumps had a lovely time in Florida. After Donald took a call about missile testing in North Korea on an unsecure phone on the patio at Mar-a-Lago, right in front of restaurant guests and Prime Minister Abe, no one in their right mind cared anymore about Melania's accidental diplomatic faux pas. Hashtag slut shame. On February 13th, I had to make a quick stop at the hospital to get a cortisone shot in my neck. The pain was becoming unbearable. The shot did not help. If anything, it made my pain worse. I think the doctor hit a nerve. Other pains in the neck were revealed by actor and model Emily Ratajkowski, who tweeted that day, "Sat next to a journalist from the New York Times last night who told me, Melania is a hooker. Whatever your politics is crucial to call this out for what it is, slut-shaming. I don't care about her nudes or sexual history, and no one should. Gender-specific attacks are barbaric, sexist bullshit." This random encounter took place at a New York Fashion Week event. I made some calls and found out that the New York Times reporter who'd slut-shamed Melania to Ratajkowski was none other than Jacob Bernstein. 1 month earlier, Bernstein had written a profile of me, and I felt the sting of his gender-specific attacks. He took pains to describe my wardrobe and put a price tag on my handbag, questioned my resume, all but said I took more credit than I deserved for my work on the Met Gala, and suggested that I buried my Catskills past so I could pretend I'd always been a Scarsdale granddaughter of Harry Winston. Bernstein could have researched his newspaper's own archives if he wanted to know the truth about my work and background, but he obviously had his hot take on me before we'd met, and he bent the facts to fit it. I had to wonder how much of it was Trump hate. Melania was quoted in that article about why she tapped me, saying I had an impressive work ethic and fantastic taste. She has a way of connecting with people, motivating them to get the job done in the best way possible. Melania was nonplussed. The media had struck again, but we both agreed that she could not ignore it and that she had to affirm Ratajkowski's message. By 7:45 p.m., I posted on the First Lady's official Twitter, "Applause to all women around the world who speak up, stand up, and support other women. At Imrata, hashtag power of every woman, hashtag power of the First Lady." The Times slapped Bernstein on the wrist, issuing a statement rebuking his loose lips. He wasn't even a political reporter, but he'd had a part in writing two flattering profiles on Princess, one that asked, "Will Ivanka Trump be the most powerful first daughter in history?" Under fire, Bernstein tweeted, "I want to take ownership of a mistake I made. Speaking at a party in what I thought was a personal conversation, I nevertheless made a stupid remark about the First Lady. My editors have made it clear my behavior was not in keeping with the standards of the Times, and I agree. My mistake, referring to unfounded rumors, shouldn't reflect on anyone else, and I apologize profusely." Glad he was sorry. Maybe he'd think twice next time before he degraded a woman. Hearts, flowers, whatever. I told Melania I'd been looking into possible locations for her and Donald to have a Valentine's Day date. She found that hysterical. In the past, February 14th had never caused a ripple of romance at Trump Tower. One thing Donald and Melania have in common, they are not sentimental types. I can't recall her ever telling me about Donald sending her flowers or taking her out on Valentine's Day or her girlishly planning a special surprise or treat for him. Since they were the first couple, however, I thought it'd be sweet and affirming for them to be seen in public, sitting across a table from each other with a candle between them. She wouldn't hear of it. OMG, winking face with tongue emoji, don't like Valentine's Day, so commercial, she said. I begged her to reconsider, if only to promote them as a normal couple who loved and cherished each other. David Mann recommended The Inn at Little Washington, James Beard award-winning chef Patrick O'Connell's Michelin 3-star restaurant in nearby Virginia, which was bucolic and adorable. I sent her a link. She said, I don't care to do it just for people. So they say, how nice. Donald thinks the same way. We don't care about Valentine's Day. I texted 18 heart emojis. She said she'd think about it, but for now is no. I kept at it, though. She finally shut me up when she sent me a text about her having made plans. She said, I talked to Donald. He is having dinner with Murdoch on Tuesday night, all set. She would not be joining. Donald and Rupert sitting in a tree? In hindsight, it was ridiculous of me to push a romantic dinner at the inn, as if Donald would be seen anywhere but a Trump property. Hervé Pierre texted that day, bad news. His best hope for a paying job hadn't worked out, and he was starting to worry seriously about money. His total compensation so far for 2 months of nonstop work for Melania had been a small fee for designing the inauguration gown and nothing for his work as a stylist. He said, "I may need to move back to France. I'm a little bit lost." "I lobbied for him, and Melania told me he needs to find a job." Princess makes her move. On February 14th, I was CC'd on an email from Katie Walsh to Lindsay and Dina Powell, Ivanka's advisor, that said, "Wednesday, March 8th is International Women's Day. It could be a great opportunity for FLOTUS/Ivanka. Would love to discuss any ideas you may have or help craft some events." Powell was way into it and replied, "Happy to work with you, Katie and Lindsay, and agree it's a big opportunity." What was going on here? The First Lady's office, me, and David Mann had been planning a lunch for International Women's Day already. It was going to be Melania's first White House event that we organized, and her big opportunity, indeed, to host, introduce the broad strokes of her platform, and talk about the UN Women for Peace Association and the importance of empowerment and education for girls. Now Ivanka, Katie, and Dina were swooping in. Melania was not having it. She told me, "Are you kidding me? Seriously? I'm not co-hosting." Soon after, Melania texted to ask why Ivanka wanted to invite Republican and Democrat senators' spouses to the White House for a lunch that was traditionally the First Lady's event. She was referring to the traditional lunch the day after the governor's dinner hosted by the First Lady for the spouses. The event location alternated yearly between the East Wing and George Washington's historic home, Mount Vernon. Cabinet members and assistants to the president were not included. But apparently Ivanka was trying to get in on this event, too. Did she know no shame? I said to Melania, "Dina said it like it was a new idea." "She can't do it," said Melania. "We need to let her know that I know that this is a First Lady event done every year." Of course Ivanka could be there as a guest, but the hosting duties belonged to Melania. Melania said, "OMG, they just want to take credit for it." Ivanka was relentless and driven. Topic A in the East Wing, Ivanka would never stop trying to muscle in on Melania's events. We had to be vigilant. Shalom. The second state visit, on February 15th, was with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel and his wife, Sarah Netanyahu. Melania would be in D.C. this time and would play tour guide to Mrs. Netanyahu, with a media posse to report on their every movement. We decided that Melania should take Mrs. Netanyahu to tour the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture. Tim Trapeppi kept sending me emails about Stephanie Grisham, of all people, saying that she was very eager to help FLOTUS in any way possible and wanted to know what she could do for us. My answer? Grisham could keep doing what she'd already been doing for us. Nothing. With the clearance and itinerary in place, Melania put her mind to the most important matter of all. What to wear? Easy answer, Lagerfeld. Melania could wear the suit Karl Lagerfeld had designed for her that she'd wanted to wear to the swearing-in. It was glorious, a white cashmere jacket and pencil skirt. She loved this suit the way a little girl loves a basket of kittens. There she stood in resplendent white at the south entrance to the White House to welcome the Netanyahus. She smiled and posed for photos, a gracious host and diplomat. Melania radiated First Ladiness, albeit with a European flair. She sat in the front row at the President's and Prime Minister's news conference in the East Room and seemed to be concentrating on the content of the discussion. Her views on Israel were aligned with Donald's. When I asked her, for example, whether the capital of Israel should be in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv, she said, "Donald wants to recognize Jerusalem." She made her own sense of his views. While I sat in the press conference, I received an email from Tim about a huge point of contention between the East Wing and the West Wing, Melania's plane. She wanted a bigger, nicer one. They wanted her to have a small one with no Wi-Fi for her flights between New York, D.C., and Palm Beach. Tim wrote, "I would seriously tell MT to tell DJT to tell Joe Hagan that she needs the C-40B to be her dedicated plane." Tim told me to tell Melania to tell Donald. What good did his nagging me to nag her do? Mansplaining alert. He began to step on Lindsay's toes, too, scheduling and showing up for meetings that he didn't need to attend and wanted to speak directly with Melania and not stick to protocol. As chief of staff, Lindsay had the authority to put Tim in his place, but he wasn't having any of it. The press conference wrapped. With entourages and the press in tow, they went to the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture and took in the newly opened exhibit. We were entering touchy territory. To open Black History Month, which had started 2 weeks earlier, Donald had had a press conference and mentioned the exhibit. I am very proud now that we have a museum on the National Mall where people can learn about Reverend King, so many other things, he said. Frederick Douglass is an example of somebody who's done an amazing job and is being recognized more and more, I notice. Activist Frederick Douglass was indeed a great man, except he died in 1895 and Donald didn't seem to know that. The risk of going to the exhibit 2 weeks after that gaffe was that it might feel like a stunt, and she'd be attacked and mocked alongside her husband. Her speech would matter. She read the following, which I helped her to compose. As we toured this awe-inspiring building, one could not help but be overcome by the bittersweet history of African Americans. Theirs is truly the story of the triumph of the human spirit over unthinkable inhumanity. We rededicate ourselves to those powerful words that both our nations hold dear, never again. I was hopeful that, after such a successful visit, Melania would embrace her role and blossom into the kind of First Lady our country would be proud of. My gratification was complete when Kate Bennett's report ran on CNN. It was a rave. Her presence Wednesday is evidence she might indeed take a more active role in official duties. Sam Feist, CNN's Washington bureau chief, sent me a note that said, "You guys had a very good day." What a breakthrough. A perfectly executed tour and speech. Favorable press. It went off without a hitch. "Great event. You were fantastic," I told her during our recap of the day. Unspoken were my thoughts about her bright future in international diplomacy. Plus, she finally got to wear the suit. The joy didn't last. On February 16th, the New York Daily News ran a gossip item that quoted a White House insider as saying, "Not only is Ivanka moving into the First Lady's office, she's redecorating it. It's what they're going to call the First Family Office." Melania said, "Ridiculous. This has got to stop." President's Day weekend. For the long President's Day weekend, my daughter, Alexi, and I flew to Florida with Melania, her parents, and Barron on her plane on Friday. David, Tyler, and Zach were going to meet us at Mar-a-Lago for dinner on Saturday night. Melania asked if I wanted to go along to a big rally on Saturday to experience the craziness. Or, she suggested, I could stay at the resort and go to the spa. "Let me know," winking face emoji. "Guess you prefer spa," winking face with tongue emoji. As I would, grinning face with smiling eyes emoji. The president's rallies were known to be unhinged, and I was curious. A facial and massage sounded incredible, but I couldn't pass up a chance to experience the rally energy firsthand. Alexi and I wandered down to the restaurant for dinner Friday night. Donald and Melania were already seated, just the two of them. They waved us over and asked us to join them. Alexi had known the Trumps her whole life, but this was her first meal with the president and first lady. She was polite and charming and sat through Donald's monologue about his electoral college victory with the patience of a saint. Saturday was busy. Donald had asked Melania to say a few words at the rally, so she asked me to come to her bedroom to work on her speech. I sat on the floor while she sat on her bed. When Donald came in to say hello, he couldn't have been friendlier. I walked out onto her portico to give them some privacy. When he left, I returned and we resumed. Melania had it all planned out. "I was thinking we should come out together," she said, which they did. She continued, "I should start and Donald stays next to me," which he did. "And I'll say, let us pray," and they do. A minute later, she wanted to know if I had a contact for Tommy Hilfiger. Afterward, I made time for a facial at the spa with Tammy Fender, Melania's longtime secret weapon, that was like a 2-week vacation in Hawaii. During lunch, Alexi and I ran into Ivanka by the pool. She caught me off guard, saying, "Let's have lunch together when we're both back in D.C. I bumped into Jared, too. I texted Melania. "I saw IT and JK. They are not coming to the rally." She said, of course they weren't. It was a Sabbath. They are being good. I replied, smiling face with halo emoji. Around 3:45 p.m., we all gathered out front by the main entrance of the resort and piled into our assigned vans for a motorcade. There had to be 20 cars, 2 fire engines, and a horde of police vehicles to drive the 20 minutes to the Palm Beach Airport. I loved the motorcade. It was impossible not to feel the excitement with so many flashing lights. Waiting on the tarmac was Air Force One, a huge plane, with a drop stairs entry right in the belly. Many familiar faces waited to board. Advisors Gary Cohn, Steve Bannon, Stephen Miller, Hope Hicks, and a dozen more. Tim Trapeppi came too, and I gave him Melania's Louis Vuitton bag to carry. Upon boarding, Alexi and I were handed towels and mints. We found cards with our names at a table, and my last name was spelled wrong again. Instead of Wilcox, it was Wolkoff, with a C instead of a K. At least they were making progress, and sat down for takeoff. Once we were in the air, Melania came to get us to give us a tour. She showed us her room, the conference room, the lounge area, and the cockpit. The three of us goofed around, took selfies, including the photo on the front cover of this book, and used the face swap filter to put Melania's face on Alexi's head. We landed at the Orlando Melbourne International Airport about an hour after takeoff at 5:42 p.m. The hangar was already packed with excited fans waiting for Donald. He and Melania deplaned to the tune of "Proud to be an American," and continued walking, not breaking stride, right onto the hangar stage. It reminded me of a model catwalk, actually. While Alexi and I watched, Melania took the microphone and delivered the speech we'd written. People cheered. I couldn't stop smiling at how far she'd come since we first met, how far we'd come as friends. And now we got to share this almost unimaginable experience with our kids. Donald took the microphone and riled up the crowd. Melania sat nearby in a chair. He finished his speech at 6:36, loosened his tie, and walked off to the song, "You Can't Always Get What You Want," by the Rolling Stones, straight back toward the plane and up the stairs, with Melania by his side. We were wheels up within minutes. When we returned via motorcade to Mar-a-Lago, we quickly changed and met David and my sons at the restaurant for their celebratory birthday dinner. Tyler's actual birthday had been the day before, on February 17th, and David and Zach were both born on February 21st. When the cakes came out with sparklers, we gathered on one side of the table to take a picture. A waiter rushed over and said, "You're not allowed to take photos." Apparently, when the president is at the Winter White House, cameras are banned. But then Donald and Melania came to our table and posed with us. Donald told the waiter we could snap away. Our last night in Florida, David and I had dinner with Donald, Melania, Ivanka, Jared, Hope Hicks, and Amalia and Victor Navs. The kids sat at the next table. Throughout the meal, Melania kept looking over at me and smirking at the antics between Ivanka, Jared, and Donald as they hashed over the topic of the hour. Was Kellyanne Conway losing it on TV? Onlookers watched our table, but the Secret Service worked double duty that night as bouncers, keeping well-wishers away. Even my kids needed permission to approach our table. Zachary came up, wrapped his arm around my neck, leaned in between Melania and me, and asked if it was safe to eat what the chef had prepared for him. Melania gently reassured him that she had spoken with the staff and chef and that it was safe for him to eat whatever he wanted. Melania had a soft spot for Zach. As relieved as I was, my son smiled and said, "Thank you. I guess there really couldn't be a safer place for my food to be prepared than with the president. Pretty cool." It was cute, and the three of us laughed. David and I, the Kushners, and the president rose from our seats to head over to the dessert buffet. Melania loves a good creme brulee. Donald had his eye on a big piece of chocolate cake, so I handed him an empty plate, my fingers on the bottom and my thumb on the top edge, a perfectly natural and normal way to hand someone a plate. He stared at my thumb as if it were on fire. I thought, "Oh shit, move your thumb." He beamed at me as he took the plate, and then, when he thought I wasn't looking, he put it down and got another. I'd seen his germophobia in action over the years, how he always kept his hands in his pockets or close to his sides, a bottle of sanitizer at the ready. When he posed in photos, he gave thumbs up so he didn't have to touch the icky hands of admirers. He was even afraid of my germs. This man wouldn't eat off a plate that had been touched by a friend. On Monday, President's Day, my family of five, Melania and Barron all flew back to New York on Melania's plane and took a motorcade into Manhattan. As soon as we landed, the Secret Service took my presidential guest badge. I could have it at Mar-a-Lago and on the plane, but forget about having a badge to get into the White House, where I really needed it. On that weekend, I felt like I was on stage with Mick Jagger and Madonna both at once. I was thrilled to ride in three presidential planes, be in four motorcades, see a rally up close, and spend quality time with my friend and my family in a gorgeous setting. I felt included and appreciated, and I couldn't wait to help create an initiative that would change lives for generations to come. I was bursting with good vibes for Melania, my work, my family. Lunch with Princess. Ivanka's assistant Mallory Harney sent me an email following up on Ivanka's invitation to schedule a lunch. I guess she had no clue that I worked with Melania, since she also requested my social security number and date of birth so that I could be granted access to the White House. I wrote back, "I'm already inside the White House. I work here, but thank you." I noticed that Mallory was using the Ivanka and Jared family email domain, not the government domain. Still? It'd been a month already. Ivanka usually emailed or texted me to ask about the dress code for events, or to get passes and tickets for her VIPs, or to recommend her friends for jobs. She once suggested I reach out to hire her ex-boyfriend's cousin, Marjorie Gubelman, to DJ an inaugural event, and recommended photographers and decorators. Now Ivanka requested a face-to-face meeting. I wondered what she wanted this time. My marching orders from Melania were to hear Ivanka out and report back. We assumed she was going to appeal to me personally to let her co-host the spouse's lunch after the governor's dinner and the International Women's Day lunch. Lunch with Ivanka was at the White House mess hall. Only assistants to the president and their guests were allowed to eat in there. I'd never been there before because I had given up my assistant to the president title for Lindsay. Otherwise, Ivanka and I would have had the same access. Instead, I had no access at all. Our meal couldn't have been more different from my lunches with Melania, which were full of giggles, affection, and stories about our kids. Ivanka asked about my family only as a launch point for getting down to business. Ivanka was so complimentary. "It's so great that you and David Mann are working here together," she said. I smiled. She said, "I know how busy you both are preparing for all of the events and all of your efforts in the East Wing." I nodded and said, "There's so much to do." Meanwhile, I really wanted to say, "Let it go. Just let us work on Melania's initiative and leave us alone." Instead, Ivanka continued with her inquiry. "What do you have going on?" she asked. "How's the governor's dinner?" I told her about the invite, which had the silhouettes of all 50 state flowers and was absolutely glorious. "Do you have a guest list?" she asked. "We do," I said, "but it's a work in progress." I wasn't about to share the names with her. Ivanka asked if I could let her know which governors were coming so she could request who she wanted to sit next to. Ivanka switched topics and thought it would be a great idea to discuss our various projects to see if there was any overlap. She'd already put her stamp on STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, which Melania had been focused on, so I knew whatever I said would be food for thought. "Tell me more about the International Women's Day luncheon," she said. I told her, "We are working with the UN Women for Peace Association." She said, "I'd really appreciate it if you could send me more info about it. I can make suggestions for guests and maybe say a few words." I said, "I'll let Melania know." From lunch with Ivanka, I headed to the high security situation room to attend a meeting about the president's first address to the joint session of Congress, which the staff was calling the State of the Union address, although technically it wasn't. I'd only heard about this meeting a couple of days ago when Lindsay mentioned it. Lindsay and Tim attended senior staff meetings but never had much to report back. Katie and company from the West Wing rolled all over them. They had told Melania, "You will need to attend this nationally televised event. Takes place at the Capitol. You are seated in a box." Melania had asked me, "What time is the event? Dress code?" I asked, "What's a box? All they know is departure and arrival time? Makes no sense." "You go to the next meeting," she told me. "Find out what's going on." Although I didn't have the clearance to attend, I showed up at the Situation Room anyway. I had to go to protect Melania's interests. Thankfully, Katie had added my name to the appointment list. I felt excited and hesitant, handing over my phone to enter. President Obama and his staff had sat in the sit room and watched as Navy SEALs killed Osama bin Laden. Critical decisions about covert operations and classified information were made at this very table. The high of that feeling lasted for a few seconds. At that meeting, I finally understood that we knew nothing. The West Wing press people in charge of organizing the event and the seating at the address informed me that there were no available seats left in the First Lady's box. I said, "How can that be? We haven't invited anyone yet." "They're already taken," said one of the bureaucrats. "By who?" "Cabinet members and other guests of Ivanka Trump." There it was. Ivanka had set up her seats in Melania's section. It occurred to me. Had she scheduled our lunch for the same day as this meeting because she'd hoped I'd miss it and be none the wiser about her appropriating Melania's seats? "The First Lady needs 8 seats," I declared. After much hemming and hawing, they agreed to free up 4 seats for the First Lady. I marched right over to the East Wing and asked for an explanation. Lindsay pointed at Tim, and he pointed back at her. "We need a solution," I said. "Not just to this, but moving forward, too." Ricky suggested a very organic fit. Children's National is opening the Bunny Melon Healing Garden, dedicated to the First Ladies of the United States, in a couple of months, she told us. Ricky organized a meeting with Kurt Newman, MD, the president and chief executive officer of Children's National Hospital. With their help, Melania invited Sheila Gregory and her daughter Jessica, who would come to the Capitol building and sit with Melania in her box. We rushed their vetting, which thankfully cleared in time. The next day, I texted Ivanka. "It was so great seeing you yesterday. I'm finishing up seating for the governor's dinner. Which governors do you want to sit with?" Her answer came quickly. Ivanka's choices were California's Jerry Brown, Massachusetts' Charlie Baker, and New York's Andrew Cuomo. She ended up sitting with the only Republican of the three, Charlie Baker. If she knew that I'd reclaimed 4 seats for Melania for the congressional address, she did not mention it. It was always sunshine and light with Ivanka on the surface, in person and by email and text. She never let down her mask, not an inch, not for a second. Mike has needs. The governor's dinner was the first large-scale undertaking of the Trump administration, with dinner in the state dining room and a sit-down performance in the East Room. During the planning, Angela Reid, frustratingly, insisted she couldn't show David Mon and me the budget of the previous year's event. Hadea Gafarian, the White House florist, who wanted to use orange flowers only, wasn't too thrilled when David removed every orange petal in the East and West Wing and replaced them with white verbeniums, lilacs, roses, anemones, and sweet pea vines. David and Ricky had a tense moment over turf. She was social secretary, but he was doing all the planning. I smoothed that over by inviting Ricky to meet with Melania and me. There was the never-ending problem of getting talent to entertain the guests. Melania fixed that by suggesting, "We should use the Army chorus you used for the concert at the mall." She was referring to the U.S. Army chorus, a group that sang at the Lincoln Memorial as part of the MAGA concert during the inauguration. We'd have them sing classics from the American Songbook in their first performance at the White House. On top of everything else, we had to organize a 7:30 p.m. small dessert reception in the diplomatic reception room for Trump's advisors and cabinet members, followed by the performance. Senior advisors weren't traditionally included, but 2 broke with tradition. Ivanka and Jared didn't seem to think protocol applied to them. Planning the seating was intense, with lots of mixed emotions. Ricky and I went back and forth with Hope, Melania, and Donald over which governors would sit where. Even Ivanka made sure to speak up. Regarding Virginia's Terry McAuliffe, a Clinton loyalist, Ricky thought it was appropriate that he be seated next to President of the United States. He is also a Dem, so we truly cover 2 birds with 1 stone. Hope wrote, "Terry McAuliffe has been very hard on the president, but DJT can charm him." Donald said, "We used to be great friends. Before." Of course, we had to beg for a budget to pay for the event and learned about the Byzantine channels and 3-letter agencies that controlled the purse strings. FLOTUS, the host of the event, was still in New York while David Mon and I oversaw the final setup. When her plane landed an hour before the party and I got notification, I texted Ricky and Lindsay, "The Eagle has landed. while they were doing their hair and getting dressed. The White House photographer, Melania, and I went into the state dining room before the guests arrived and took some pictures of her in the beautiful, elegant room. David had outdone himself with a green and white eternal spring theme, with light green damask table coverings, the George W. Bush state china with its green lattice pattern, and an eclectic combination of round and rectangular tables. Lindsay's frustration with her job was starting to show. I got it. This was a highly unusual situation in a highly unusual White House. She was the chief of staff, but every decision went through me. That morning, she'd said, I only had half an hour with FLOTUS, and she talked about flowers the whole time. But meanwhile, I'd had private time with Melania to review her schedule and spent the night in the residence. I would relay to Lindsay everything she needed to know. FLOTUS wore a black Dolce & Gabbana gown with a slit to her mid-thigh, sexy, dramatic, and regal. I was still very much on the American-only bandwagon and had tried to pair her with designers Ken Kaufman and Isaac Franco for this event. But after hearing that Ivanka had worn a Kaufman-Franco dress for a different event, she said, forget it. If Ivanka was dressed by a designer, Melania would cross them off her list. Too bad for her, I thought. They make the sexiest red carpet looks. We disagreed over the press release with a surprise combatant. David and I worked on one that described the menu and the flowers and included a nice quote from Melania about bringing together all 50 governors in the spirit of bipartisan unity. On top of the usual hurdles we had to go through to get West Wing approval, Melania decided she didn't want us releasing too much information. I don't want to put out the details, she said. No one needs to know what we're eating. It was an early sign of how Melania's intense privacy would affect her role as First Lady. Refusing to share the menu with the media seemed like passive-aggressive withholding to me. The press kept emailing questions about the food, the decor, the band, the china, the seating. But Melania said, nope. It was almost as if divulging the details spoiled the experience for her. After a delicious dinner, the President and First Lady left the state dining room first, followed by the Vice President and Mrs. Pence. The four of them, and me, waited in the Red Room for the guests to assemble in the East Room for the entertainment. The four of them took a seat and got to talking. I decided to stand right next to Melania. Mike Pence brought up Trump's Justice Department and Department of Education's rescinding of Obama's federal protections for transgender students that allowed kids to use whichever bathroom they wanted to. Jackie Evancho, the America's Got Talent singer who performed at the inauguration when no one else would, has a transgender sister. On February 22nd, 4 days earlier, she tweeted, "At Real Donald Trump, you gave me the honor to sing at your inauguration. Please give me and my sister the honor to meet with you to talk hashtag transgender rights, heart emoji." Trump didn't acknowledge the tweet or reply to Ivanko. I don't think Vice President Pence did either. The Supreme Court would be hearing a case about the same issue. Melania was confused about why Donald felt compelled to put himself front and center on the bathroom issue. He could have done nothing and avoided upsetting the LGBTQ plus community. Once the Pences were gone and it was just the three of us, Melania asked Donald, "Why did you get involved?" I asked, "In what? That bathroom thing?" He said, "You're right." Then he clasped his hands and looked into her eyes and said, "I didn't need to get involved. I could have let the Supreme Court deal with it, but it was very important to Mike." Mike Pence really, really cares about where people go to the bathroom. The next day, February 27th, Melania, Karen Pence, their various team members, and I attended the National Governors Association luncheon for the governor's spouses. I asked Melania to enter the room arm in arm with Karen in a show of solidarity. She did. Terry McAuliffe's wife, Virginia First Lady Dorothy McAuliffe, chose the theme for the event, childhood hunger prevention and nutrition. I'd written Melania's speech with her. She told the room that she cared about children's issues and invited the guests to get involved with her initiatives. I sat at her table next to Mrs. McAuliffe, who was so polite and engaging, and, as Melania's senior advisor, I spoke to her and others about what Melania and her team planned to do to benefit children. It was so gratifying. I forgot about the pain in my neck for an hour there. Afterward, Melania and I went up to the residence, talking about the warm welcome she'd received and some details about the upcoming Easter egg roll on the White House lawn. and that night I went to sleep in my usual room, number 326. It had been a good day. State of the Union. On Tuesday, February 28, 2017, President Trump was giving his first speech before a joint session of the United States Congress. I woke up at 3 a.m. with a debilitating cramp in my leg. It felt like I'd been shot. I texted Lindsay to ask for the address of the nearest hospital. She gave me the information, but I didn't go. I knew that if I went to the hospital, I wouldn't come out for days. I planned on flying home, but Melania decided that she wanted me to stay in D.C. and invited me to her husband's address to Congress. I'd already peeled off my fake eyelashes from the spouse's lunch and was looking forward to returning to my family. But Melania said, "Please stay." I couldn't say no. I was upstairs in the residence with Melania when Jared came up to bring Donald his speech to review. Jared said a quick hello to us and asked if it was okay for him to enter Donald's bedroom. Melania thought the president might be taking a nap. She said, "Go ahead." Jared went inside. An hour before the address, Melania and I were taken to a holding room in the Capitol building right across from the congressional chamber. Jared and Ivanka were also there, just the four of us, waiting to be announced. We took a bunch of pictures, as we do, and Ivanka was as sweet as always. Melania wore Michael Kors, a black skirt that showed a lot of leg. I told her to place the event pamphlet in her lap to cover up some skin. I felt like hell because of my neck and tingling leg. Lindsay and Tim had told me what a big deal it was that I got to hang out in that holding area with the family before the address, and they couldn't believe I was going to be in the chamber when the president spoke. "No one gets to go to the congressional address," Lindsay had said. "The staff stays downstairs." I still couldn't understand why Lindsay and Tim didn't demand that the First Lady's box be occupied by her guests, rather than Ivanka's and the cabinet secretary's. Melania was announced and called to enter the chamber. She said, "Walk with me." I walked behind her and tried to duck out of camera range. We were led to her box. Sheila and Jessica Gregory from Children's National Hospital were there, as well as Susan Oliver and Jessica Davis, wives of Deputy Sheriff Danny Oliver and Detective Michael Davis Jr., pillars of their community who were slain in the line of duty in California. It was an honor to be in the room with the families of these heroes. Only after Melania sat did I realize that the seats were all full. I was standing on the steps next to Melania's aisle seat with nowhere to go. She looked at me and glanced down, signaling me to plop down on the stairs next to her. My wobbly leg and aching back groaned in protest as I sat on the hard step. When the camera came our way, I ducked and slid over, or bent down, so that I wasn't in the shot with Melania or blocking the people being honored behind me. Every time we had to rise to our feet and applaud something Donald said, I hauled my large frame off that step and came all the way back down, dozens and dozens of times. I squatted more in 2 hours in front of the entire world than I had in a gym for over 2 years. The stress on my back was beyond. During those ovations, Melania picked and chose when to stand. I told her through my teeth, "Stand up." It was as if she didn't think she had to. The queen does not stand with the masses to praise the king. Ivanka sat with Karen Owens, the widow of Navy SEAL William Ryan Owens, who'd recently been killed in Yemen. The crowd gave the widow an ovation for more than a minute. Mrs. Owens was sobbing openly throughout. Ivanka stood next to her. At one point, she comforted the widow with a pat on her back. I whispered to Melania, "You should turn around." She shook her head. When we had the chance to talk, she explained she didn't want just to do that, and I knew she was referring to how Ivanka used that moment. Melania did not do what people expected her to do, period. She'd only do what felt right for her. That night, Melania and Donald were sitting out in the sofa area of the residence. I didn't want to intrude. I told Angela Reed, "I'm just going to peek in and wave goodnight before heading upstairs to my bedroom." Not wanting to intrude, I kept my distance from the sofa area, but when Melania saw me lurking, she patted the seat next to her on the couch. Some advisors stopped by to talk politics, and I mainly listened as they spoke. At the end of the night, Ivanka and Jared had to go, but I got to stay. I had a big realization that night about the difference between Melania and Ivanka. Melania would not play the sympathy or the drama card. Ivanka stacked the deck with them and made sure the cameras captured every moment. Although Ivanka gave the appearance of warmth, people questioned her sincerity, even if it was genuine. Melania gave the appearance of coldness, but she was authentic and genuinely felt sorry for Mrs. Owens. Her authenticity and common sense were what drew me to her, again and again. She was who she was, and that had been fine in New York. But in Washington, compared to ingratiating Ivanka, Melania's refusal to go through the motions was not sitting well with the press. My job, among all my other responsibilities, was to convince Melania to dance, just a little, baby steps.